Welcome to this fifth episode in series two of Nightmares of a Doctor. In this series, we explore the extremes of human existence. Some of the themes in these stories will be challenging, and listener discretion is advised. If you are suffering from a mental health condition and find yourself in need of advice, try to speak to a loved one or someone you trust. If you are still unsure, you should seek advice from your registered GP. If you or someone you know are dealing with a mental health emergency, don't hesitate to contact your local emergency services or crisis support team. Talking costs nothing, but it could be worth everything. So much of recent human history has been marked by the notion that men and women should each have their own distinct societal roles. But when we look back into the ancient world, we find those self-imposed rules to be interpreted variably. Archaeological evidence from the 1st century AD shows us that women of the ancient Celtic and Gaulish tribes of northern Europe were more than capable of maintaining high social positions, often as secular or religious leaders. Although hardly the norm, some even rose to positions of exceptional power, such as the Queen Boudica of the British Iceni tribe, or Queen Cartamandua, who led the Celtic Brigantes. As well as being queens, both are examples of warrior generals who led formidable armies on ambitious campaigns. At the beginning of the 20th century, the world was endowed with major technological and cultural advances. But despite all of the progress and exponential growth, it is possibly one of the most sexually divisive centuries of our species. It is only in our very recent history that the balance of power between women and men has been meaningfully questioned. In August 1920, women in the United States gained the right to vote. It was a major victory, but in truth, the fight for their equality had barely begun. It was a time when their social inequality combined most unfavorably with the deeply ingrained prejudices of the legal, political, and even scientific communities. For a single woman with no advocate male, any aspect of their life was made problematic. As perverse as it may sound, even a trip to the doctor was likely to be humiliating by today's standards, but at worst, it could even be life-threatening. One beautiful morning in March 1928, Christine Collins said goodbye to her 9-year-old son, Walter, before handing him some money to spend in the movie theater. Christine left for her job in the city of Los Angeles, where she worked as a telephone operator. As a single mother, her life was hard, but she loved her son dearly, and she earned enough money to survive comfortably in their working-class suburb. But after returning from work, Christine was confronted with every parent's worst nightmare. Her child, Walter, had vanished. When Christine reported his disappearance to the authorities, the nation's press soon saw the opportunity to turn the story into a high-profile missing persons case. Months of searching followed, but there appeared no sign of Walter. Through those tortuous months, Christine would have suffered terribly, but the Los Angeles Police Department found themselves facing a very different kind of pressure at a uniquely challenging time. At this point in 1928, the reputation of the LAPD had been badly damaged by sensationalist stories of corruption, cover-up, and murder. The troubled city was overrun with ruthless mobsters running bootlegging operations, prostitution, and illegal gambling rackets. High-profile cases such as the rape and murder of starlet Virginia Rappe in 1921 and the kidnapping of evangelist Amy McPherson in 1926 had subdued the city into a state of unease. Mayor George E. Cryer was tasked with fixing the chaos in his city, and he enforced his rule through Police Chief James Two Guns Davis, so called for his characteristic gunslinger pose. The LAPD responded to the crime wave in brutal fashion. Under James Two Guns Davis's leadership, his team developed its lasting reputation as an organization reliant on violence and intimidation. Their failed attempts to solve the case of Walter Collins' kidnapping was rewarded with an onslaught of negative publicity. Christine's resilience and stoicism in the face of her son's disappearance appealed to the defiant working-class sentiment felt by many of the newspaper's readers. Their collective horror at the disappearance of the boy and the perceived failures of the police further highlighted the LAPD's shortcomings. As attention snowballed into a nationwide story, so did the pressure mounting on the police. Their efforts were complicated by the hundreds of false sightings and blind-ending leads. Walter had allegedly been spotted as far north as San Francisco and Oakland. Elsewhere, the boy's father had been serving time in Folsom Prison for 8 unrelated armed robberies, and he was adamant that his son had been harmed by former inmates seeking revenge. Police investigated both the sightings as well as the father's claims, but neither proved useful. After 5 fruitless months, a lone boy matching Walter's description was discovered in Illinois, and the whole country waited with bated breath. Letters and photos were quickly exchanged, and the authorities believed the case close to being solved. Christine was required to pay the $70 in expenses to return the boy to LA, while the LAPD made preparations of their own. This human interest success story provided a timely resolution to the intense scrutiny overshadowing their work. Their failures in fixing the crime-addled city and the string of corruption scandals might all be forgotten, provided they were recognized for their involvement in Christine's case. Police Chief James Davis organized a frenzy of media interest to accompany the reunion of mother and child. Their hope for redemption was not to go to plan. The child from Illinois was not Walter Collins. Christine immediately and repeatedly insisted the boy was not her Walter, but her efforts were rebuffed, and in the glare of the spotlight, the attending officers insisted straight back. As recounted from the city council hearing transcripts of the day, Christine was forcibly told to try him out for a couple of weeks. Totally disorientated and overwhelmed by her grief, Christine buckled beneath the weight of their pressure. She did what she was told and took the boy home. The boy was adamant that his name was Walter Collins, but Christine knew enough to know the child was not her son. She collected testimonies from friends who knew her son well and gathered dental records specific to Walter. After 3 weeks looking after the child she considered an imposter, she returned to the police and presented her evidence. Rather than admitting their terrible mistake and seeking a resolution, the police force responded with unhinged outrage at being defied by a woman. They bullied and insulted her, ferociously flexing their powers of intimidation to coerce Christine into closing their case. They allegedly said to her, "What are you trying to do? Make fools of us all? Or are you trying to shirk your duty as a mother and have the state provide for your son? You are the most cruel-hearted woman I've ever known. You are a fool." By this point, Christine was both desperate and determined in equal measure. She had no thoughts for herself, only for her son, who she desperately missed. No number of insults or pressure of intimidation could persuade Christine to abandon her son. When the police realized she would not bend to their will, they had her committed to the psychiatric ward at Los Angeles County Hospital under a Code 12 internment, a term used to admit a difficult or inconvenient person, usually a woman, to a psychiatric ward. Under the authority of the police, it was a code they could execute without any legal due process. An admission to the places once referred to as lunatic asylums would have been a frightening experience in 1920s America. Psychiatry as a medical specialty was in its relative infancy. Panicked patients would suffer terribly with unopposed mental health diseases, which themselves were managed ineffectively by uninformed doctors whose treatments were often unproven or experimental. In the absence of effective medication, patients were mostly managed by applications of restraint. But by the end of the 1920s, alarming experimental techniques were insidiously becoming mainstream. Some patients were intentionally infected with malaria to induce fever in the hope that it would treat infections of the brain. Electroconvulsive therapy involved attaching electrodes directly to the skull before applying an electric current to induce a seizure in the patient, a technique once used indiscriminately to treat a range of mental health disorders. Most troubling of all was the procedure that would become the flag bearer of psychosurgery, the procedure known as the lobotomy, a technique that was thought to cure mental health conditions by surgically severing connections in the brain. It should be said that the precise nature of Christine's treatment is not clearly known, but she was kept against her will for 5 full days for a fabricated illness invented by the police. While it is unlikely that she received any of these treatments, which in theory were reserved for the very sickest patients, there is no doubt at all that many psychiatrists at this time took a very liberal view of medical ethics. As a result, many patients were subjected to painful, degrading, and unnecessary treatments, which in the absence of rigorous research were often based solely upon experimental ideas and vivid imaginations. During her incarceration, the police saw no option but to question the child who Christine rejected as being her boy. The boy's thinly veiled deception quickly wilted beneath the weight of their interrogation. The boy confessed that his name was Arthur Hutchins, and he was 12 years of age. He was a runaway from Illinois, but originally from Iowa. A drifter at a roadside cafe saw a resemblance between the lone traveling Arthur and the much publicized photos of Walter Collins. When confronted by the questions posed by the drifter, Arthur saw an opportunity to improve his situation. When police questioned him on his motive, he admitted that he wanted to travel on to Hollywood to meet his hero, the actor called Tom Mix, who was renowned for playing cowboys. As a 12-year-old boy, vulnerable and alone, it is likely that Arthur just wanted help. Christine had been harshly and unnecessarily imprisoned into a psychiatric hospital that was just as injudicious as the LAPD. Little is known about Christine's time spent in hospital or what treatment she endured, but under the intense public pressure, it is known that she was eventually released in one piece. Despite their best efforts, the LAPD had been unable to silence the mounting support for this single-minded mother, unwavering in her struggle to bring the authorities on track and continue searching for her son. In the face of her demands, the LAPD were compelled to pay Christina's case the respect it deserved. Arthur's admission had brought them back to square one, but they would not be there for long. Speculation linking Walter Collins' disappearance to a spate of recent child kidnappings would soon uncover a disturbing new lead. It was a lead that suggested something even greater and something far darker. Prior to 1930, the town of Mira Loma was known as Wineville, named for its role in the booming wine culture. This area of California was quickly becoming popular with migrant workers, particularly those whose farms were failing in the barren Midwest. The promise of work prompted a surge in immigration, leading to an opportunity for the well-placed landowners. Many migrants came to find their fortune from the grapes, but what they found instead were the grapes of wrath, as John Steinbeck put it, for the workers were frequently exploited for their labor and forced to exist in terrible conditions. Gordon Northcutt was one of these exploitative landowners who at the age of 19 had bought a plot of land and built up a chicken ranch. he was successful in persuading various young boys to come and work on his ranch, including his nephew, 13-year-old Sanford Clark, who travelled from Saskatchewan in Canada to provide his uncle with labour. Gordon wasted no time in putting his nephew to work, but when Sanford was unable to meet his uncle's expectations, Gordon would punish him with regular and vicious beatings. Surrounded by empty miles of sunburned fields and stunning Californian landscapes, Gordon found omnipotence in his remote country ranch. He could do anything to anyone without fear of retribution. His beating of his nephew soon escalated to sexual molestation and full-blown torture. But worse, he used his nephew to find self-fulfillment in even sicker fantasies. Sanford's sister, Jessie Clark, was 19 years old when she came to California to visit her brother. Shortly after arriving on Northcutt's ranch, it quickly became apparent that not all was as it seemed. Sanford found the courage to tell his sister of his treatment, but he also revealed something far more sinister. Sanford was not the only one to suffer at the hands of Northcutt, for Northcutt had used his remote family ranch to systematically abuse many other young boys. And when Northcutt had grown tired with torturing and abusing them, he would murder the children using hatchets and hammers. Jessie was horrified at what her brother had told her, but she couldn't find a way to escape with her brother without endangering them both. She retreated to Canada, but contacted the American consul, who in turn informed the LAPD. When officials came to investigate her claims, Northcutt must have known that his crimes were catching up with him. Officials found Sanford and took him into their care, while Northcutt fled into the surrounding woodland. From his relative safety, Sanford revealed the full extent of Northcutt's crimes, detailing the abuse and molestations of the children, their agonizing imprisonment in nightmarish chicken coops, and their undignified disposal into bonfires and shallow graves. In September 1928, Northcutt was caught trying to cross the Canada border, while searches of his farm revealed blood-stained axes, as well as the personal effects belonging to absent children. Their search also revealed multiple grave sites, which housed the remains of the tortured boys. Northcutt would confess to murdering 9 boys, but without the necessary evidence, he would only be charged for 3. 2 of these victims were brothers, Lewis and Nelson Winslow, while the 3rd, Alvin Gauthier, was found without his head. Sanford confessed that he helped his uncle to dispose of the skull. In February 1929, Northcutt was convicted for the murder of the Winslow boys and Alvin Gauthier. There had been insufficient evidence to charge Northcutt for the others, to which he'd freely confessed, nor was he charged for the disappearance of Walter Collins. But it didn't make a difference. He was given the death sentence. No physical evidence was ever found linking Walter Collins to Gordon Northcutt, who up to this point had strenuously denied any involvement in his disappearance. Despite the possible link, Christine remained convinced that her son was alive and continued her search. But in October 1930, Christine received a telegram from Northcutt saying that he had lied about his denials of Walter. He promised he would tell her exactly what had happened, but only if she came to hear it in person. Christine became the first person in more than 3 decades to receive permission to visit a serial killer on the eve of his execution. But when Christine came to see him, he had abruptly changed his tune. "I don't want to see you," Northcutt said to Christine. "I don't know anything about it. I'm innocent." The following morning, Northcutt was executed by hanging. 5 years later, a child who Northcutt had claimed to have murdered was found alive and well. His pathological dishonesty gave Christine all the hope she needed to keep searching for her son. Although Christine would never know the truth of what happened to her son, she clung to the hope until she died in December 1964 at the age of 75. Despite her great suffering as a determined woman fighting in the face of a misguided system, Christine's legacy would be far more reaching than she could have possibly realized. When the LAPD had imprisoned Christine for refusing to accept Arthur Hutchins as her child, the flames of discontent were being resoundingly fanned by Reverend Gustav Breergleb, a Presbyterian minister, a radio evangelist, and something of a thorn in the LAPD's side due to his continued criticisms of their ineffectual bullying tactics. Despite the terrible injustice of her unnecessary subjugation, Christine had emerged from her psychiatric imprisonment more determined than ever. Reverend Breergleb was an outspoken community activist, and he sympathized greatly with Christine's suffering. Through Breergleb's support, she realized the importance of fighting the many injustices she had suffered, which themselves had distracted from the search of her son. Breergleb used his powerful community presence to highlight Christine's story. Through radio shows and sermons, he demanded that the public never turn a blind eye to the repeated corruptions and malpractices of an egotistical and out-of-touch police force. Breergleb worked tirelessly with both Christine and her attorney to file a false imprisonment complaint against the city and the LAPD. The senior police staff were astonished to learn that their unchecked authority had been challenged so brazenly, not least by a woman. She took them to court to face trial for their crimes. At the trial she had prompted, thousands of enraged Los Angeles citizens packed the council chambers to hear Police Chief James Two Guns Davis testify his defense. Christine won. The LAPD was ordered to pay her $10,000 in compensation, and disgraced Police Chief James Two Guns Davis was removed from his post. From that point forward, as a direct result of Christine's case, California State Legislature made it illegal for the police to commit any individual to a psychiatric facility without a legally justified warrant. Psychiatry as a medical discipline is unlike any other in that the patient's best interests aren't necessarily what the patient wants. As a doctor, how can you manage a patient's self-harm or attempts to commit suicide without imposing some restrictions on their freedom? No other discipline is quite so controversial, and many of its decisions are tightly controlled by complex medico-legal processes. Nowadays, modern psychiatry is rightly regarded as a formidable force for good, improving the lives of billions of individuals. But as this story shows, psychiatry as a specialty has not always been so refined or even scientific. In the pre-digital age of the early 20th century, scientific causes were liable to be corrupted by personal ambition or strength of personality, rather than the intended pursuit of knowledge. Historically, knowledge obtained by diligent observation was closely guarded by the medical community, precluding any challenge to an emboldened authority. Nowadays, with a wealth of information at every patient's fingertips, abuses of power are rightly made far more difficult. A perfect system requires perfect operators, and history has shown us that doctors are less than that. Under these conditions, when the doctor is empowered by absolute trust, the temptation to reshuffle the order of priorities clearly becomes difficult to resist. When the patient's best interests are usurped by ambition, scientific interest, or perhaps just curiosity, the most abhorrent acts soon appear justifiable. Feeding into this patriarchal and thankfully largely historical system of medicine are other social constructs and pseudoscientific prejudices. Not least amongst those was the perceived inability and fragility of women, a most prevalent notion amongst so much of human history. This manifested profoundly in an obsession with a condition known as hysteria, a condition considered inextricably feminine, So much so that the word hysteria comes from the word hystera, the ancient Greek word for uterus. When such inbuilt prejudice is combined with unchecked power, terrible injustices soon become inevitable. Nearly 80 years after Walter went missing, journalist and screenplay writer J. Michael Straczynski brought Christine's story to the mainstream in the 2008 film Changeling, directed by Clint Eastwood and starring Angelina Jolie. Although Christine died in 1935, not knowing what happened to her son, Straczynski sums up the power of her legacy when he said, "The core of it all is Christine Collins' desire to find out what happened, and never giving up, no matter what anyone threw at her. She never abandoned the quest to find out what happened to her son. That tenacity carried her through things that would break anybody else, but she never once stopped fighting." Thank you for listening to this fifth episode in series 2 of Nightmares of a Doctor. Information regarding the sources used for this episode are available in the show notes. If you have any further thoughts or feedback for the show, please feel free to get in touch via our Instagram account at Nightmares of a Doctor or via email nightmaresofadoctor@gmail.com.